Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of March. All things political. We always have all things political Mondays at 9 o'clock, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. First, we want to say thank you so much for making our winter membership drive a great success. We raised together more than $826,000 from more than 6,900 members to pay for Wisconsin Public Radio programs like this one, and we added a number of new members to Wisconsin Public Radio as well, more than 1,500 new members. So thank you so much for all of your support. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Professor Charles Lipson, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. Professor Lipson, thank you very much for being with us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Oh, great. Yeah, we have a really good line with you. It sounds like you're right next door, sir.
I wish I was up in Wisconsin. I wish I was there.
Well, come on up anytime. Let's start with the elections in Iraq. Was it a sign that the U.S. can now feel somewhat confident that the country is secure enough so we can leave?
I think you've got it exactly right. I think this was, first of all, a show of incredible courage by the Iraqis that came out to vote yesterday in the midst of terror attacks. I think it shows that our last-ditch effort, which was the surge a couple of years ago and the related changes in our strategy begun under the late Bush administration, continued under Obama, have had a good effect. But I don't think it's all over yet. There were a number of things that suggested some potential problems to come.
Such as?
Well, for one thing, as your audience all knows, there's a real split in the country between the majority Shiites and the minority Sunni, and there were a number of Sunnis who were not allowed to run in the election, and some Sunnis boycotted it. There was also participation by the radical cleric. I think he's less important now than he used to be, but al-Sadr finally participated rather than boycotting. But then that leaves the question of whether he'll have any role in governance going on. So there are problems to work out going forward, but and we don't know exactly what the composition of the government will look like. And if it's formed soon, that would be a good sign rather than taking months and months to do it. But on the whole, I think America can feel that things are at least moving on the right track, and that the policy on which we spent so much blood and so much treasure has finally yielded some of the results we were looking for, and our withdrawal can continue. And in fact, it should be complete by the middle of the summer, maybe a little bit later than that.
And do you know, Professor Lipson, what signs exactly are we looking for to make sure things will be good enough for us to leave? Are there indications?
Well, there'll be two signs. There'll be two signs that are really, I think, important. One is whether or not we're seeing any sectarian fighting. This would not only be between Sunnis and Shia, but there are some cleavages among the Kurds up in the north over who will run that territory. And then the second would be whether the government itself, the central government, looks to have broad participation or whether it looks like a sectarian Shiite government on steroids.
It has been a long war, hasn't it?
It's been an incredibly long war, but to the extent that we're involved in problems involving non-democratic governments in a very difficult part of the world and dealing also with terrorist groups, al-Qaeda in Iraq, for example, over the last several years, this may be the sign of the future. Everyone knows that it's going to be a long slog in Afghanistan as well. Our goals there are much smaller. In Iraq, we really do need to set up a government that will be able to sustain itself over the long term. Our goals in Afghanistan are much slimmer, I think. There, I think our real problem is that we do not want al-Qaeda or related organizations to be able to set up camps where they can train people to attack the United States or Western Europe.
And do you see any signs of progress in Afghanistan?
Yes and no. I think if we'd continued along the same lines that we were going up until President Obama finally made his decision to send in more troops, I think we would have lost there. Then different people in your audience will have different ideas about what the consequences of that loss would be. But I think that we've stopped the downward spiral. I think that the uphill slog will be a more difficult one and will be a costly one. I think what you're seeing there is how difficult it was to take even one town, and the person who's come in to be the local leader there turns out to have a violent past, surprise, surprise, in Germany where he was for a while. But we're also now beginning to get a lot of help from the Pakistanis. Why is that important? It's important because the Taliban was in part a creation of the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI. They wanted a kind of controlled government. Maybe an Islamic extremist government wasn't exactly what they wanted, but they were certainly willing to take it on their backside so that they could face toward India. I think that they now see that they themselves are really threatened by local Taliban, by the Taliban in Afghanistan. So they've helped us more. I don't know that they've exactly flipped to our side, but they're helping us more.
A lot of people have concerns about the corruption in the current government and how it is we're going to be able to rid that country or help rid that country of corruption, which seems to me would be necessary in order for us to withdraw from there. Are we doing anything in that regard? Is that hugely problematic?
Let me understand. You're asking a person in Chicago how we can get rid of corruption?
Oh, I'm from Chicago.
We wouldn't know anything. I've never heard of anything like that down here. I think that that we're not going to be able to get rid of corruption there. I think the main issue will be to reduce it to levels where the local governments there can perform effectively. The real problem with corruption there is that it's completely pervasive. And worst of all, it's gone down to the level of local police and the like, so that often what was happening was that the Taliban would come into a community, and instead of the locals siding with the police were so corrupt and the local government was so incompetent, they would go over to the other side. I think that our strategy is also not exactly to wipe out corruption. I think that all these talks that we'll deal with some Taliban but not others, what does that mean? I think what it really means is that we're willing to cut a deal with warlords who have made a tactical alliance with the Taliban themselves when the Taliban were on the up, but they're willing to make a tactical alliance with us if it looks as if we are going to be able to kick the Taliban out. But they could flip back just as easily, and of course they're corrupt to the core.
And what about the help we're getting from the Pakistanis that we didn't have before? What's causing that? Why are they stepping up to the plate, and what are they doing?
I think that the reason they're stepping up to the plate is that the government in Pakistan itself sees an internal threat from these groups. I think that they've given – there's a huge hatred of the United States in Pakistan. The United States is not beloved in any sense in Pakistan by the people. But I think that the Pakistani government is very concerned about attacks that were beginning to look as if they could overthrow the entire government. Remember when they moved into a valley fairly close to some of the key cities in Pakistan over the summer? I think that those were real wake-up calls. The Pakistani government, I think, made a decision that they might be better off trying to push these guys back rather than trying to cut a deal with them, and we're the beneficiaries.
And do you think we're there for a long, long period of time?
Well, yes and no. I think that this is not something that might go like Iraq could go. Iraq looks as if we'll get a stable government. It will be reasonably pro-American, although it'll probably end up with good relations with Iran as well. We can then step out, but we'll need to give the Iraqis some support to make sure that the Iranians are not dominant within the country. I don't think that we're likely to have quite such a strong government in Afghanistan. We won't have to be there, I think, in large numbers, but I think that our concern there – and we need to keep our eye on the ball. What's our concern? Our concern there is to make sure that the bad guys are not using it as a training area. But there are a lot of other places in the world that they're trying to set up. Somalia, there are even places in South America and so forth, regions where they either find a friendly state or a lawless area where they can set up. And I think we have to be concerned there. And as you can see, there's also real problems within our own countries on the security side. I mean, leaving aside all the issues of health care and schooling and all the other things we need to spend our money on. So I think that these are not wars like World War II where you just go home. But the question is, what kind of a presence do you need to have there?
Right. Let's turn to health care for a moment. We've been on this issue for so long. You're getting a little bit of an indication over the past couple days that the Democrats don't have the votes.
Yeah, my sense is that this is one of those watershed moments in American politics, Kathleen, in the same sense that in the mid-1960s when the Civil Rights Acts and the Voting Rights Acts were passed under Lyndon Johnson. This is a kind of critical moment. Why do I say that? I think that the fight has turned into more than a fight about health care. It's a fight. Americans basically want to see incremental changes rather than vast changes. They want to see somewhat less costly changes than huge costly ones. They want to see less centralized Washington power. Boy, have you seen that in elections all over. They want to see simpler programs that they can understand, not really complex programs that run thousands of pages that are hard to understand. And I think there's a general view, and you can see it on Capitol Hill, that really that the larger the initiative, the larger the base of support should be. And this push does not have, it appears, even majority support among the public. So I think that the Democrats who vote for this and who are in anything other than very safe liberal districts face a real risk, and you can just see that. I don't see that they have the votes right now, and I think that the idea that in effect one more speech, one healthcare summit or something will reverse things, I think turned out to be false.
And what risks do you think the Democrats face if nothing passes?
I think they face risks if something passes, and I think they face risks if nothing passes.
Oh, my.
I think that they've gotten themselves into a very difficult position. If it does not pass, people will want to know how and why the Obama administration spent one-third of his presidency on a program that had only support from the middle and left wing of his own party and that did not have public support and that managed to ignore popular will. And I think that they will be in big trouble on all that. If it does pass, I think there will just be an outrage around the idea that this program was passed on a pure party line vote with a lot of corrupt dealings behind people's back over the expressed will of what looks to be a majority of the American public.
And what is it? I'm having a hard time understanding what it is that the American public would like. Do you know what we agree on? Do you know what would be acceptable? Do you know what could pass and wouldn't upset people?
Well, first of all, I think that healthcare is not the number one issue for most people. I think for most people, according to virtually all polls, the number one issue is a very shaky economy. President Obama has to get good marks on the fact that if we'd been talking a year ago, we were just past the very worst part. It looks as if the economy has righted itself, but we don't know if there's going to be a double dip and unemployment is still very high. People are concerned about health care, but I think there's a real concern, as I said earlier, about very large programs of unknown consequences that could potentially break the bank. And this program is filled with gimmicks that make it look budget neutral. The biggest gimmick is essentially that there are the Congressional Budget Office is limited by law to making a 10-year survey of the costs. Knowing that, the bill was set up so that the taxes ran for the first 10 years, but the benefits largely did not kick in. The financial costly benefits didn't kick in until 4 to 5 years down the road. So you're getting 10 years of taxes paying for the first decade of the program, but you're only really getting about 6 years of benefits, maybe even a little less. The second decade, it'll be 10 years of taxes and 10 years of benefits. And what people are expecting at that point is that it will break the budget.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll start taking them in just one moment. Our guest this hour for all things political is Professor Charles Lipson, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. Big vote in Iraq, where we started our conversation today, also Afghanistan, and we're looking at whether or not the Democrats have the votes for health care and whether or not it would do in the Obama administration. We have yet to get to this part of the conversation. If nothing does pass, does it put in jeopardy really dealing with the economy, with energy concerns, et cetera? We have lines open, so join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, the Ombudsman for National Public Radio will be joining us. Let's go to phone calls, starting with Jim from Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about capitalism today because it just strikes me how imperfect we are because we're ostensibly, you know, we're the best system, but we, in many cases, we exploit people. And we use any means to win, and then we resist any effort to regulate behavior. And I thought the guests might be interested in this because there are a couple things that I cut out of the Chicago Sun-Times, and these are enticements for the poor under auto loans. And the first one says, we approve all credit types, cosigner, no cosigner, first-time buyer, short-time a job, collections, and short-time in the country. And the other one says, have you ever been turned down by a bank, car dealer, or finance company, we can help you. Bad credit, slow credit repos, judgments only. Why buy a lemon only own a 2010 today? And then it says at the bottom, because Chicago has a large Polish immigrant population and many Hispanics, it says we speak Polish and si hable Espanol. Now, these people will be able to buy these cars, these poor people and working poor, but chances are, with the easy credit and the interest that they're going to be charged and all the obstacles that they have, they're not going to be able to keep these cars, and they're going to be in all likelihood to lose their investment. And then when people try to put out any laws to regulate them, the result of that is that the people will resist the regulation and say that it's oppressive by the government. But in actuality, it's repressive on the poor, and it's unfair exploitation of them, and we ought to do something about it.
Professor Lipson.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that, Jim, you're right in the sense that there has been a large pushback about the failure of regulation and the failure of the government to act during the financial crisis in particular. There's been a lot of pushback on payday loans and other exploitative loans. I guess the only thing that I would say just to offset a little bit of the argument that you're making is, while it's true that there are exploitative banks and loans and so forth, you can't counterpose that to the idea that the government will do a great job and a disinterested job in regulating. And that's not just because sometimes the regulators are captured by the institutions that they try to regulate. That happens too. But look at how much of the housing crisis was caused by government policies that were designed to do exactly the same things that you're talking about, namely get people who should have been renting homes. They didn't have much of a down payment. They didn't have a lot of money in the bank. They didn't have a secure financial situation to get them into houses, and they've defaulted and they've defaulted in large numbers. That's put whole neighborhoods in peril because people who did have enough for their down payment now find that their home values have gone down. So it's true that we need better regulation, but you can't just assume that because there are exploitative practices in the private sector that the government will serve as a white knight to get things in. A good example might be the Toyota situation, where these cars won't stop and didn't seem like they would stop. That's a private firm, and it appears that they knew about this for a long time and didn't do anything to stop it. But where were all the federal regulatory agencies? Where were the reports? Where were they during all of this? So you can't. So there are problems on the private side, but I would just add that there are problems on the public side as well.
Thank you, Jim, so much for your call. Paul from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Yes, I was just I was looking at a something, hearing about how there are no benefits.
Do you have
Kathleen? I'm getting feedback.
I know. Do you have your radio on, Paul?
No, radio's off. It's all on
yeah,
the telephone.
I know it is in the phone. We can hear you though. Just go ahead with what you're saying. And
okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay, what the professor was saying, you know, confuses me, because he is saying that there are no benefits the first year. So let me just quote, you know, President Obama in his radio address. Small business owners will receive tax credits to purchase health care next year. Thousands of uninsured Americans will no longer be denied insurance because of pre-existing conditions. There will be no more caps, either annual or for a lifetime. Young adults will be able to stay on their parents' insurance policy until 26. There will be an appeals process for people who feel they're unfairly denied a claim. And seniors will have help covering that donut hole in their Medicare Part D. All this starts next year, but the professor says there are no benefits next year.
That's not exactly what I said, Paul. But I take your point. There are going to be some benefits for the public. There's no question about it. You've got that exactly right. What I'm saying is that the cost, the heavy cost to the government, the benefits that are costly, for the most part, will not start for about 4 to 5 years. That's why the program looks to be financially balanced over a decade. I'm not saying that the public won't receive benefits, and you're right to point to several of them. Most of the benefits that you're pointing to, nearly all of them, have to do with regulations on the insurance companies. And for all the bashing of the big firms and so forth and the special interests, I hope people have noticed that the special interests have actually almost all signed up for this bill. The opposition to this bill is not being led by a group of big businesses that are out there running a big Harry and Louise ad campaign or anything like that. No, this has been public opposition at the grassroots. It's not been big. So why would insurance company? And you're right also, Paul, to point to the major benefit that people really do want out of this. They want less arbitrary treatment by their insurance companies. People are angry at insurance companies. They're angry as soon as their arm hurts, the insurance company starts going back through all of their past records to say, oh, you know, your arm was hurting 5 years ago. It's a pre-existing condition. You hadn't signed up with us then. And they don't like the lifetime caps. And all these issues are real issues. You're quite right.
And let me be clear about this. Do you think that the insurance companies are okay with this bill, or are they in opposition to it?
Originally, the insurance companies were okay with it. And the reason they were okay is the following, Kathleen. They were going to be regulated more heavily so that they were going to end up looking like a lot more like a public utility, like your gas or electric company. But in return for that, they were going to get all these new customers who were going to be the younger customers, the people who weren't on insurance. So on the whole, they thought it was likely to go through. If they tried to oppose it, they would just end up on the outs and they would be attacked by the administration. So they ended up cutting a deal. The insurance companies weren't really against it. Now, however, the deal is such that a lot of the new customers really will come in with lower, less valuable policies. So, but you haven't been seeing on TV, at least we haven't around here. I don't know if you have in Wisconsin. Have you been seeing a lot of big, expensive paid advertisements against this health care bill?
I've seen a few, but not many.
Right. Not a lot. There weren't all the Harry and Louise ads
No.
that you saw. Okay. So what does that tell you? It tells me that the big moneyed interests, the corporate interests, have not, the special interests, have not been, for the most part, opposed to this. Big pharma and big insurance have not been really opposed to this. I think big insurance has now moved more negative, but they haven't been opposed to this. This has been a grassroots uprising against this bill.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. We go to Nick from Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hi, folks. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
You're welcome.
See, after I guess fairly frustrated, again, living in Madison, very very liberal. I'm more of a conservative or middle bent, but I just don't understand common sense wise, greater good wise, after watching this for, you know, longer than a year, how it even gets to this point. Is it really just boiled down to the politics? But even politically, it's a bad deal for everyone involved. The fact that the overwhelming majority, public opinion, is against this. They don't want it. I think everybody would agree that we need some sort of health reform. And the fact that conservatives also want that, but they just want to have some say in it, and that the public at large should have say in it. I don't understand. Does it just boil down to they're trying to save their tail because they're so deep into it? It's just so frustrating day after day to listen and watch, and it's just like completely have their blinders on when it comes to what the average Joe wants and says
okay.
they want. And you've mentioned the grassroots uprising many times, and it's true, and it's not. I mean, if it's going to happen in Madison, Wisconsin, I can only imagine what it's like in other places.
Professor Lipson.
I think Nick has absolutely nailed it. I think that's exactly it. As you were talking, Nick, I was thinking back to my childhood. I used to go down to the Gulf of Mexico sometime to visit my family. My grandmother lived down there. We would go out fishing for crabs. And when you fish for crabs, you put out a net, and the crab – basically, you put out a little box that the crab can crawl into, but it can't crawl back out of. And I think that's kind of what's happened to a lot of Democrats on the health care bill. I think that there was initially a fair amount of support for it. I think the more people learned about it, and we've seen this time and again with polling, the more people have kind of backed away from it. And I think that the sheer complexity, the centralization in Washington, and the overall cost of it have made people say, I think we'd like to start with something smaller. We have some real problems here. There are problems with pre-existing conditions. There are problems with caps. There are problems with unfair treatment. There are also some problems with insurance companies not competing across state lines. There are problems with doctors having to do defensive medicine. We'd like some smaller programs that begin to address a number of these. Let's hope that that can be done. What I fear is that if this goes down, what will happen will be that the Democrats will say, hey, the Republicans wanted nothing. We're not going to give you any health care reform at all. And in fact, we'll be stuck in the same position. They also want the cost curve bent. They want they believe that rightly that medical costs have been going up too rapidly, and that's why insurance costs have been going up. That's absolutely right. But the current bill doesn't do anything really to save that, with the possible exception of taxing the Cadillac plant.
What about the issue, though? And I think that everybody could agree on this, that the number of people who don't have insurance, and I run into them all the time, you can be just wiped out for the rest of your life if something happens to you. 48 million is what the number is right now. And it seems to me as though it's in everybody's best interest, because it is true, there but for the grace of God go I. It's not a good thing to have that many people who don't have insurance.
You're absolutely right, Kathleen. And the numbers, you cite 48 million. The numbers are that I've seen are substantially lower than that. That, for example, includes everyone who's in the country illegally, and it includes a lot of people who have chosen not to buy insurance. So typically younger people. My own kids are in their mid-20s, and I've worked with them to make sure that they bought insurance. It's costly, and a lot of kids would say, hey, you know, I can do without that $150 a month expenditure. I think that those are issues that do need to be addressed. In particular, we've got a system that makes it very difficult for individuals to buy policies. So the kind of thing that you're talking about, it seems to me, needs to be addressed by two things. One is large deductible policies. In other words, if you have an expenditure of more than $40,000 or $50,000, which would wipe you out, you need an insurance policy for that, but not necessarily for something that would cost $5,000. And some people would buy those kinds of policies if they were available. They also need to have more alternatives to going in, if they don't have insurance, to going into an emergency room. There need to be urgent care rooms that are freestanding, where a person who's fallen down and hurt her arm or something like that can go in without having the very high expenses of going into an emergency room. We need interstate competition on insurance. Insurance costs a huge amount less in Pennsylvania than it costs in New York State, but these companies can't compete. So there are a number of reforms that need to be made. The question is, will those reforms be made if this bill does not go through? What I'm saying is, I can imagine that people will think this is the third rail of American politics and be very wary of doing anything.
Thanks, Nick, very much for your call. Lori is next from Madison. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Yeah. My original understanding of the purpose of this bill was that not only was it to provide insurance to people who desperately need it, but also as a way to start reining in the cost of Medicare to the government, because that's one of the major costs that are causing the huge debit problems that we have. Has that provision or not been addressed? Is that dropped out of this bill at this point?
Not entirely, but largely. And in fact, last week, Warren Buffett, who is a strong supporter of the president and had been a supporter of health care, said that he had backed away from supporting the bill precisely because it does not do anything to control costs. One of the things that needs to be done is the federal government should probably put a lot more money into training healthcare professionals. I didn't just say doctors. We need a lot more money that goes into nurse practitioners, nurses, a whole variety of paraprofessionals so that we can treat people in an efficient, effective way. But in fact, the current bill, the only thing that it really does to bend costs is a tax on the very expensive health care plans. But that's in one of the two bills that's passed. It's not in the other. And if they go to reconciliation, it's unclear what would be left in the final bill.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk a little bit about some of the Chicago people, because you're joining us from the University of Chicago, who are close advisors to the president. The New York Times, I'm sure you saw it, had an interesting piece on David Axelrod yesterday and whether or not he's too close to the president, what happened to the vision that the president seemed to have at the beginning of his presidency. What do you think of particularly Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel and some of the others who are from Chicago, who you must know their work and their backgrounds pretty well? Are they serving the president well? Is it time to clean house?
Well, I know these people. I certainly know David Axelrod. I've known him for years. I know President Obama. And I wouldn't say I really know Rahm Emanuel, but I've certainly met him. I think what happens is that the president comes in, and I know Valerie Jarrett not well. I would say that the president, any president, comes in surrounded by people that that he trusts and that help get him elected. And then if his early going is successful, they're bouquets for everyone. And if the early going is not successful, generally – the advisors to the king are blamed and not the king himself. What we saw last week in the Washington Post was the beginning of kind of public infighting, where some people were saying, look, the people around the president, Axelrod and Gibbs and Jarrett, are hero worshipers, and all they are is yes men and blah, blah, blah.
That. Right.
And then they said, Rahm Emanuel, he's a centrist and a more practical guy, and gee, if they paid attention to him, they wouldn't have gone for such a big health care bill, and they would have focused in a different way and so forth. And I who knows whether any of this is true. I think that the fact is the president of the United States has made these decisions. If this bill, the health care bill in particular, does not go through, they'll stick with the current people through the midterms. But after the midterms, if there's a big loss, whether they hold their majorities in both houses or not, if there are huge losses, there'll be some house cleaning.
Mm-hmm. And would you like to please assess the president's performance to date?
I think that it's been a rocky start. I don't think that that's news to anybody. He came in with huge amounts of goodwill. He also came in, I think, as a number of his people have said, facing a number of big messes. He made a number of very grand statements very early. He was going to close Guantanamo within a year. He was definitely going to change the way that terrorists were treated in a way that he thought was more in conformity with how he understood the Constitution and our basic sense of rights. He had very big plans in terms of increasing social programs and changing the way America was perceived in the world. I think that he has been partly successful in reaching out to the world, but I don't think that he's got very many concrete achievements that he can show in the foreign policy area outside of Iraq, where he has largely followed the Bush administration's policies. He has had big, I think, successes after a shaky start in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where he has changed the policy. He can take credit or blame for that, but he has increased the number of troops there and vastly increased the number of Predator strikes, and that appears to be going relatively well, and he will get credit for that. On the other hand, there haven't been a lot of other foreign policy successes, and the whole domestic agenda has been held up by health care, and your listeners know as well as I do what the state of that is.
Mm-hmm. Professor Charles Lipson is our guest for All Things Political, professor of political science, director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. Thanks for your call, Lori. We have one line open, 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that's come in, Professor Lipson. Given what you have been saying, the professor, it seems like we should just throw up our hands and surrender and become another American country with a wealthy ruling class and the rest of us counting for nothing. Our schools are starving for funds. Generations of families have sat in front of their televisions and consider themselves informed and believe problems can be solved within an hour. Where is their hope for anything to be fixed?
Well, that's exactly my view. We should all throw up our hands and go home and start drinking heavily. No.
I didn't think so.
No. I think that that what you're seeing is basically that this is a centrist country, and we want problems to be solved, but we don't want to hand over all of our problems to Washington to be solved by some centralized government and some bureaucrat there. We want them to be solved. We want to work on those solutions. We want to start with kind of more incremental solutions. And let me give you an example. I think that the problems here are very grave. And the reason I think that they're grave is I think that the whole country was built on ideas of local government being strong, local community organizations being strong, the state governments being relatively strong, and the federal government not being the overweening power that it is now. A good example would be schools. Until a few years ago, schools were essentially a local operation. And what happened was people said, well, we need more federal money. Well, the federal money came in. And what happened immediately thereafter was the federal government said, and understandably so, if we're putting in the money, we want a lot of control over where that goes. And we not only want control over where that money goes, we want control over where all the other money that goes into schools is being spent. And so what's happened, with no real national discussion of this, there has been national discussion of No Child Left Behind and this and that and testing and that sort of thing. But there's been no real national discussion of the movement that led from local control of schools, fairly decentralized, to more and more and more power over schools being in Washington, D.C. Now, I happen to think that Arne Duncan, who is the Secretary of Education, is one of the most brilliant appointments of this administration. I think he's done a great job. I happen to know him, but I mean, I don't know him really well. It's just that this race to the top has led to an enormous number of positive changes. But that doesn't override the issue that schools used to be a local issue. And I think that part of the underlying debate about health care is how much people want everything to be solved in Washington, D.C.
We go next to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I hate to be a skeptic, but I just don't see a lot of opposition to this bill. I know that Republicans go on TV and they talk about the opposition to the bill, like 60% of the American people don't want it. I just don't see evidence of that. I don't see huge marches in Washington. You know, I see the Tea Party, you know, raising a big stink, and basically core Republicans, you know, upset about it. But I just don't see a big groundswell of opposition to this bill.
Well, the polling results do show that President Obama, though he's controlled the airways on this, and there's been no real heavy opposition from the big organized interest sector, has not been able to convince the public. There is a fair amount of opposition. I'm reminded of the fact that when I lived in London for a year, I worked at the London School of Economics for a year, and Margaret Thatcher was in power and was at the height of her power, and I literally never met a single person who had voted for her. And that told you more about the people I knew than about where the country was. And I wonder, in your case, John, it may be that the people that you know really do support the bill, but the polling results show that there is a lot of opposition.
Thanks, John, for your call. Mary from Dubuque. Hey, Mary.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi. Well, you know, I think this, the whole healthcare thing is very tragic. I think the polling depends on the way you ask the question, and I think that healthcare is responsible. Well, especially the insurance companies are responsible for the greatest transfer of wealth from the middle class to the power elite. I mean, you see them making billions of dollars, and people are going bankrupt trying to pay for their health care and trying and being sick and losing their health care. Now, I mean, if I had it my way, I wish that the Democrats would have just passed Medicare for All. I wish they would have allowed everyone to buy into Medicare and pass that through reconciliation, because you know that the Republicans would not even stand behind that. They don't want anything, regardless of what they say. They don't want anything that's going to make this administration successful. But I think people should just be allowed to buy into Medicare because it has such a low overhead, like 2 or 3%. And also, if we allowed people to buy across state lines, wouldn't everybody just go to the states with the least amount of regulation, like what happened with credit cards? And then how would that affect the sickest among us? They would still, I mean, they'd be out of insurance because the insurance companies that go to the least regulated states would be charging the most amount of money for them. They'd still be in the same place that they are now. It's just, you know, that people would flee to least regulated states.
Well, you've raised a number of very serious points. There's a lot of anger out there, and you're really expressing it very clearly, Mary, about the insurance companies. And I'm certainly not here to defend them. But I think that the real reason that there are two problems with insurance companies fundamentally. One is that the rates are high and going up, and the other is that they treat a number of people, feel that they've been treated unfairly, that they're kicked out when they need coverage. The first point, the rates have been going up. That's because costs have been going up. So ultimately, you won't be able to get any changes in that unless you change the underlying cost structure. All the profits of insurance companies are not especially high compared to other kinds of corporations. They're just not. And if you eliminated all those profits, they wouldn't knock down healthcare costs. The second point that you're making, though, about companies treating people unfairly. They say you've got a pre-existing condition when you really didn't. They exclude you. They cap you. They do all of these things. Those are real things that people are really angry about. As for regulation, you've got a point there as well. But a part of the cost is that in some states, if you buy insurance in California, for example, you personally would have to have coverage that included acupuncture. You might not want that. You're paying for it anyway. And so some states allow you to buy much thinner coverage, which might be what some people want. They want emergency coverage for really big things. They don't want everything to be included.
Thanks, Mary. We have 1 minute left. Let's take one more phone call. Becky is next from New Berlin. Hi, Becky.
Good morning. I'm questioning the validity of the polls with regard to this health care, because they include a majority who are against it because it's too weak and a majority who are against it because it's too strong. I'm one who thinks it's too weak, so I would say, no, I don't like the bill because I think we should have a single-payer system. But the polls can't distinguish between that when you get a compromise bill.
Well, that's an interesting point.
It's an interesting point, and I think that that's right. There are people who are essentially against it because they think that it's too watered down. The biggest spokesman for them in the past week has been Michael Moore. So there has been a criticism like that. All I would say about the people who talk about the polls is that nobody watches the polls more closely than your elected representatives, and they do not see a groundswell of support for this. If they did, you wouldn't have to engage in the Cornhusker kickback and the Louisiana purchase and all the arm twisting that's going on now. By the way, the votes on this, I've looked at some of the political betting markets, which are the best ways to look at what the chances of passage. It's 50-50. So the people who still want it, there's a 50-50 chance that it'll go through. I personally think that it's not likely to go through, but hey, I'm not betting any money either.
Thank you, Professor Lipson. We're out of time. We got to go. Thank you so much for being with us. Professor Charles Lipson, our guest, he's been with us before, professor of political science and director of the program on international politics, economics, and security at the University of Chicago. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this All Things Political program. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll return. We have another hour coming up this Monday, and we'll be speaking with the Ombudsman for National Public Radio. Should be a great show. So stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.